This is Mae Brussel. It is side two of broadcast number 696. The program is called World Watchers, April the 8th. It is now 1985. Getting back to the quotations from Citizen News, the book of Citizen News by Michael Drosnin, Howard Hughes was ready through the judges and the Justice Department to win over antitrust suits and implications because he already had substantial cable TV ownership and holdings, and he had, in quotes, a wide range of electronics equipment, manufactured communications satellites, and he owned KLAS in Las Vegas, Nevada. As he was prepared to throw in the towel, and he was afraid that he would have to appear, Hughes was deploying a growing platoon of lawyers and fixers and bagmen to help him take over ABC, and he wanted to get former Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg to handle the legal conflicts, and he wanted to work with Lyndon Johnson, who, according to this story, also felt that the TV was biased and it wouldn't be a bad idea. But as he swung into the final days of his two-week crusade, Hughes had all kinds of strategies ready and set for him. But then it goes on when all the papers were counted, and he had 1.6 million shares, more than a third of the outstanding stock in ABC. They still insisted that he would have to appear in person for the Federal Communications to grant the license. It was the one thing he could not do. He was informed on Monday night the FCC would definitely demand his appearance. Now, we're talking about 1968, and I said that Hughes was never physically seen from 1966 until from the Boston Hospital, where he had brain surgery, and then was taken to Greece, and he was dead by 1971. And this book covers a period of 1966 to 1970 where he was completely faceless and as a ghost. But when he was told on Monday that he would definitely have to appear, the FCC said that noon on July 16, 1968, a formal statement was issued. Hughes rejected the stock and his bid to take over ABC to have a network of his own. Now, I always said that the Howard Hughes organization from 1966 on, or earlier even, was the beginning of the Nazification of America, that this faceless person was controlled by the Central Intelligence Agency. Robert Mayhew, the agent in charge of the huge connections and communications during this period, was from the FBI and the counterintelligence group, along with William Casey. And it would have been nice to have this faceless person be able to buy that major network. But the condition was that he had to be seen. And he brings up the issue, or is quoted in the book, that nonsensical quotation. Well, if I don't show up, it'll bring up the rumors of my death. Well, that's all the more reason. If he just goes into a room one day and they see him, then the rumors of his death stop. But the fact that he wanted it and didn't show up should increase the rumors of his death. But because the CIA and the intelligence community already own so much of the news media, and heaven help us, as they take a tighter stranglehold, nobody hardly ever brought up the question of his death until the time of Watergate in 1972, when Congressman Rosenthal and others were going to declare him legally dead. Now, a World Watcher, a friend in New York, just gave me last week a book review from 1966 on Howard Hughes. It was written by John Keats. This was a long time ago. That was 2 years before he was trying to buy up ABC. That book came out. 1966 was the last year that Howard was ever physically seen. And just this quick book review is in the New York Times, just to give you the essence of what they were saying to Howard, about Howard before he was wanting to buy so hard the ABC network. It says, Howard Hughes, like the faltering titan in a Hollywood mock epic, Howard Hughes has slowly, perhaps deliberately, allowed the power that money can buy to slip through his fingers. Holed up in a tightly guarded Bel Air mansion known to outsiders as San Limbo, he no longer makes movies or designs planes or controls exclusive patent rights to oil drilling bit invented by his father that has gushed a steady stream of millions since 1908. He has suffered surrendered ownership of the Hughes aircraft, a huge and usually successful electronics firm, to an institute for medical research, and, too late for this first full-length biography, to have included, he recently gave up a 6-year legal struggle to recover control of Trans World Airlines by selling his shares for $566 million. Now, in 1966, when this book was written, Howard, who, wherever he was, and at that point he was taken by Robert Mayhew and John Roselli to the Boston Hospital, had just received the cash of $566 million. He gave up everything else, his airplanes, his designs, his patent, his oil bit. He surrendered everything, the used aircraft, and now he's going into a Boston hospital for head surgery, accompanied by John Roselli of the Mafia and Robert Mayhew of counterintelligence of CIA and FBI, holding $556 million. Those are the millions that bought up the Las Vegas tables and brought in Intertel and the other network that took over after Howard. But this review of the book just simply mentions in 1966 how he was divesting himself of everything. And it's interesting, if he was doing all that, why he was so determined to control politicians and control ABC Network in 1968. Or, again, I ask, after 1968, when there's no longer use, if they could have pulled it without you seeing use, then the CIA would have bought ABC in 1968 instead of 1985. Also, a quotation from Michael Drosnin's book. He's getting a lot of publicity on this book from the LA Weekly. They asked him how he happened to go after the story, and Drosnin said, "I didn't set out to go after the Hughes story. I always said there were two things I wouldn't be a part of, the Kennedy assassination and the Howard Hughes story. I saw them both as bottomless pits, no way to unravel these stories." So he claimed he was looking for information on the Glomar Explorer, the men who ran Counterspy in Washington, D.C., an investigative magazine that has some very good articles, stated that one of the gentlemen stated he would never go into the Kennedy assassination or Jonestown because those were black holes or bottomless pits. So it's interesting how, in writing this book with Robert Mayhew's links to these various possibilities of the assassination of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King under the Hughes umbrella of the counterintelligence, and with Guy Bannister, the links of Mayo to Bannister, many, many links to the assassination of Kennedy, Drosnin said there are two things he wouldn't touch, the Kennedy assassination and the Howard Hughes, and really his book is an avoidance, a total avoidance of the Howard Hughes story. Now, in the past few weeks, in addition to William Simon getting in the act with Ted Turner and Jesse Helms to try and take over CBS, and William Casey and his company and the communications network taking over ABC, Mr. Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch, bought 50% of 20th Century Fox. That's the studio that I have followed for a long time with you and shared information about Marvin Davis. He took Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger off the board recently, although they get certain salaries for going to the meetings. And, of course, William Rogers of the State Department is still on the board, and the late Grace Kelly. And Joseph Schenck of 20th Century Fox, one of the original founders, was a Knight of Malta, active with the Vatican, and it was 20th Century Fox that gave the original land to Ronald Reagan, the $2 million that made him a wealthy man, that got him started with material wealth and a ranch in California, came through 20th Century Fox. Now, the last time I was talking about Rupert Murdoch, the last few times, one, he owns the London Times that put out the story of the Hitler diary. All that happened with that was payment was made of $3 million to the Waffen-SS, the Nazi link to the Odessa organization, to Otto Skorzeny's group, the late Skorzeny, and the living Nazis that were Adolf Hitler when he died and up through the current Nazi network organization. They get old and their children need money, I guess, to go to college or whatever. And there's a fund called the Hague, H-I-A-G, of the Waffen-SS. Well, the $3 million that came from Der Spiegel and from London Times went to the Waffen-SS. That trial is still going on in Europe, and I have to update you on the news on that trial. And also, at the time of the grenade invasion and when Edwin Meese was under examination and a few newspapers were asking questions about Edwin Meese, not many, it was Murdoch who flew into Chicago and plunked down something like $50 million and bought the Chicago Sun with the statement that Mike Royka had it on Phil Donahue's program, remember I talked about it. There'll be no more talk about Edwin Meese and no more talk about Grenada. And so that is the power he has. Murdoch came in. He has a lot of holdings. He keeps compiling new holdings. He recently bought Ziff Davis Publications for $350 million. The New York Times had a breakdown of the holdings of Mr. Murdoch. In case you wonder about it, his News Corporation, the Australian parent company, that's where he came from, is one of his major holdings, the Cruden investment, the Murdoch family holding. Then he has the News Corp investment, British holding company, News Limited, Australian holding company, News Investments, British company, News International, the Arnset Transport Company, 50% holding, Australian subsidiaries, 51 operating companies, 27 newspapers, Channel 10 in Sydney, Australia, Channel 10 in Melbourne, and its British subsidiaries are 28 operating companies, including the News Group, which is the Sun, that's the show, and the News of the World, and then the Times newspaper, the London Times, the Sunday Times, satellite television, and his American subsidiaries. There's 10 operating companies, the New York Post, the Boston Herald, the Express News, Village Voice, Chicago Sun-Times, San Antonio, the Express, the Star, the New York Magazine, New Women Magazine, Travel Weekly Magazine, and then 10 other magazines he recently acquired, as I say, from Ziff Davis last November. Now, he came in with a hunk of money. Mark Rich was bought out after his criminal investigations. He was the partner of Marvin Davis and 50% partner. He bought in with Marvin Davis at 20th Century Fox. And Mr. Murdoch plunked down this money and hidden between the lines, according to the New York Times, of the discussion of Marvin Davis and Mr. Murdoch is how much the decisions will be made by Murdoch now that he's come in and rescued Marvin Davis. What will the tone of the studio be like? Well, that's a good question, given his desire to plunk $50 million to stop talk of Edwin Meese. You can imagine the propaganda and the kind of material or the movies that they'll be making. Their recent movies were horrendous. They were losing money by the millions. The Taste of Marvin Davis and Henry Kissinger and Gerry Ford isn't so great with what Americans need in way of entertainment. But he does own this particular empire. And now he's moved to Hollywood, and of course 50% of that owning, a good hunk of it, is up here at Pebble Beach. They own Pebble Beach and part of Monterey and Seaside. Now, the Counter Spy magazine, many of you have it. If you don't, you should take it. They've changed their title to National Reporter. And just this last issue came out, their first with a new title, Winter 1985, and it's about Tufts University and the CIA infiltration or takeover of the Foreign Service and the Law School Department. And the reason I bring it up now is that Murdoch's name comes into this article because a director of the CIA was recruiting at Tufts, there at Medford, Massachusetts. This was last October, and 25 students had a protest and stopped them from being allowed to speak. And they tried to show the people in charge of the university how the CIA had lied to the American people and broken the policies, violated campus recruitment activities, their promises. For example, they say they're going to be truthful. They've lied on different points. And the point is that the students were temporarily suspended, and they were apprehended but allowed to continue as undergraduates, but the CIA could not recruit. They were temporarily suspended recruiting undergraduates until they could determine if university policies had been defeated. What this article goes on to say is that while the university officials were going over the confrontational policies of students versus CIA recruitment on campus, the Boston Herald, it goes on to say, the local Rupert Murdoch paper was outraged that the university would listen to the students and not slam on them for their stopping the CIA. It said, the Boston Herald, the local Rupert Murdoch paper, was outraged enough to run a lead editorial titled Tufts Wimps Out with its CIA ban. What they were doing was stopping the CIA recruitment on the campus while they went over the policies of the CIA, and they referred to U.S. ambassadors who were part of the CIA activity who had graduated from the university's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, Mr. Thomas Pickering from El Salvador, Dean Hinton, and Robert White. And much of the school is known for their CIA foreign service, their law department, the CIA, and undergrads and grads being recruited as undergrads and going over to Washington, D.C. for interviews to go into the CIA. So the point is that even in a town like Medford, Massachusetts, where there's a large enclave of future CIA students, the influence of Murdoch, of Rupert Murdoch, shows up in the editorials of the paper of cracking down on the university for even listening to the arguments of the students. So this gentleman, with all these holdings, is able to influence the politics of the local neighborhoods in ways that we can't even imagine. Another gentleman who is growing in his influence in the news media is Reverend Moon. And recently he had a convention of 400 people, news people, invited to South Korea to look favorably upon Moon and Moon Organization. And the head of the Washington Times, the editorial head for Moon, said the way to control the world, or to paraphrase it, is to control the minds of the people, and that the newspapers would be doing that. Now, Newsday had a story March 28, 1985, The Mainstreaming of the Reverend Moon. And this is a long article by the religious writer, three pages, saying that more than $500,000 in funding has been put up for a new conservative political religious relations group called the Coalition of Religious Freedom, led by evangelical Baptist preacher working with the Mooney Church. And this article is long, big letters, seeking respectability and how the Moonies are reaching out and they don't like to be a cult, and that their property and their programs, valued at more than $10 million a year, is subsidized by church income from industries and fundraising from Japan and South Korea that is poured into our country. Now, in the past 3 weeks, Mr. de Borsgrave, Arnold de Borsgrave, who has been one of the main factors of disinformation with Michael Ledeen and Mr. Pazienza and Claire Sterling in lies about Italy, about the Pope shooting, about terrorism around the world, Mr. Arnold de Borsgrave has been made the editor of the Washington Times, bringing with him the Rome desk, the connections to Licio Gelli, to the P2, to the Knights of Malta, all the Italian fascist connections that go into the intended plans to have a military junta in Italy that didn't take place in 1981, and to try and link the Pope's shooting to the Russian-Bulgarian connections. All of these parts are working with Mr. de Borsgrave, who now becomes the editor of Reverend Moon's paper. And this article, Seeking Respectability, goes at great length into how Reverend Moon is becoming legitimate, and he's getting himself accepted by the religious leaders around the world. It says, over the past decade, the church has spent millions of dollars on interdisciplinary conferences for scientists. Now they're doing it for newspaper people, editors, and publishers. This church began seriously courting other church ministers last year following Moon's incarceration. Hundreds of ministers have been invited to conferences sponsored by the church directly or by CAUSA, C-A-U-S-A, a church-funded anti-communist institute. And, of course, Mr. Moon and CAUSA work closely with John Singlaub of Western Goals and the World Anti-Communist League. And the material that I've had on the air for the last 3 weeks of these interconnections go closely to Moon and his relationship to conservative organizations who want to turn the world Christian. And the article says most people reject Moon's theology, but they accept his strident anti-communism, and they're finding the evangelical Christians are joining with Moonies as their strange bedfellows, but they're blending together their anti-communism and unification theology. And Mr. Bellow, who heads a group called South Carolina Citizens for Morality, says that after church leaders questioned him on his influence in South Carolina, they offered him a $150,000 donation for his ministry. And he works with the Moonies, and money is coming from all kinds of organizations. The evangelical, the far right, the Vatican are blending with Reverend Moon at all these different levels because of their violent anti-communism. This article goes on to say that when Terry Dolan, the founder of the National Conservative Political Action Committee, accepted $500,000 from Moon sources to start a new anti-communist organization, he was criticized by what he called the Christian right, who are nervous about the connections. But he feels comfortable with that, and Paul Weyrich, a conservative who formed the Committee for the Survival of a Free Congress, questioned what Moon might be asking Dolan in return. Weyrich, of course, is a Catholic and helped fund Jerry Falwell, and he sees that Moon is funding Dolan, and all of them seem to be getting in the same big mattress or waterbed together. This article says some church groups are warning their clergy to avoid Moon conferences and are urging them to discard their information kits. Leaders in the United Methodist Church and the Evangelical Free Church of America urge members to erase videotapes sent from the Unification Church and their information kits. But Moon is spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, recently $500,000, with tape cassettes and lectures for the various churches around the country to help him and them in this fight against anti-communism, so that pouring in to Central America and around the world, and in all the major countries and minor countries too, is this violent form of anti-communism and repression of people at the same time that the whole goal is through the will of Christ or whatever it is. They have a common bind to keep the status quo in these various countries, while the people that run these shows have unlimited wealth to do whatever they want. And regarding just one final point on this news media story and the takeovers here, regarding the MGM and Alexander Haig being put on the board of MGM, he had a big role in having that movie Red Dawn made, that violent anti-communist movie. And New Times, the magazine from the Soviet Union, mentioned that helping with the filming of this movie, actually doing the gore splashing sequences and the gifted actors that were professional mercenaries, they used the Soldier of Fortune publisher, Robert K. Brown, who's a close friend of the man who produced the movie, John Milius. And to make Red Dawn, they used the actual anti-communist Soldier of Fortune mercenaries to make this very authentic, how the Russians would be taking over the United States. And it refers to various people, a pair of intrepid paratroopers who, after rehearsing in Honduras, were instructing the Nicaraguan Contras and how to dynamite fodder storages and how to murder children and ambush people. Then these two show up, and they're not the only mercenaries who sold their talent to Hollywood. At the annual Jamboree of Professional Mercenaries in Las Vegas, they encountered their old pals who recently had been perspiring before the cameras. They were military consultants for the notorious Soldier of Fortune magazine and gave stories about the mercenaries and worked for Robert Brown and helped with that movie. And then, of course, as soon as that movie was made, Alexander Haig, on the board of MGM, flew it to Washington for the president to see. And close to Soldier of Fortune, I've mentioned this before, but I bring it up again, is Michael Ledeen, who writes editorials for Soldier of Fortune, August 1984. He has one on violence and terrorism in South and Central America. And it says Michael Ledeen is a senior fellow in international affairs at the Center for Strategic International Studies at Georgetown. Now, I wanted to spend time continuing from the news to Michael Ledeen and Mr. Pazienza and the stories that are going on in New York City, the arrest of Pazienza, the death of Grace Kelly's brother and her brother-in-law, and the Vatican scandals that linked to Ronald Reagan. I won't have time to continue that, but going the transition that I have here, and we'll do as much as we have time for, and then continue it next week, one of the common denominators is Michael Ledeen, because of his close links to the Vatican, to Licio Gelli, the P2, to the Italian secret police, and Ronald Reagan and Georgetown. Then Michael Ledeen is the connection to John Singlaub, Soldier of Fortune, Robert Brown, Alexander Haig. So that these people that are making our movies, that are sending out this propaganda and inciting people to be fearful of the invasion of the Russians, and teaches how we will suffer under their hands and what we should sacrifice when they arrive in this country are closely linked also with Alexander Haig. Haig is close to Ladin. Ladin worked for Alexander Haig in the State Department. Ladin works for Mr. Brown, sends letters to the Soldier of Fortune. He has links to the disinformation on the shooting of Pope to try to make it a KGB plot. So that these various names, whether it's William Simon or John Singlap or John or Michael Ledeen, weave in and out of the acquisition of studios, of movies, and propaganda. And I bring up the name of Ledeen and Red Dawn and Haig right now because with Mr. Murdoch taking over 20th Century Fox, there's a studio that will be absolutely influenced the way that Kurt Kerkorian and Alexander Haig are influenced, and unless the stockholders realize that they're getting propaganda and bad movies that don't make money, nothing will happen except propaganda, and they'll be subsidized by the CIA for making the bad movies. But the intelligence communication system has for a long time been influential in Hollywood, but it's more apparent now, and with Murdoch going to Hollywood, I'm sure he'll do to the movies what he did to the Chicago Sun and sanitize the quality of the kinds of films that people deserve that they're not going to be able to get. I'll begin with this part on Grace Kelly and do as much as I can, as much as time allows, and hopefully pick it up next week. In November of 1982, November the 2nd, 1982, I wrote a story for the National Examiner, Why Grace Kelly Was Murdered. And I put in the article the fact that she had close links to the Vatican, that Roberta Calvi had just been killed in June, that she was either a spy or a courier for the Vatican, and the Examiner had a picture of John Paul, and inside the Vatican, another picture, an Archbishop Paul Marcinkus and Roberta Calvi, and I mentioned that Paul Marcinkus was privy to the secret $1.2 billion that was missing out of the Vatican Bank, and that Michael Sindona was in prison, that God's banker, and that seven people had been linked to the scandal, the Vatican scandal, and had been murdered just before Grace Kelly was murdered, who had wind of what was going on and referred to another witness who lived near Grace Kelly, who later was murdered, called the exterminator, who killed an investigator for Michael Sindona. And in this article, I quoted various statements from the book, The Vatican Connection by Richard Hammer, and the role of the Mafia, the Vatican, and the hierarchy, the P2, Licio Gelli, and the role in the terrorist bombings in Bologna, and that the relationship of Licio Gelli to Prince Rainier in Monte Carlo was very close, that he went to Monte Carlo. In fact, when he left Italy and fled, the Prince Rainier and Grace Kelly had taken care of him there. She was part of the P2 lodge there, as is Henry Kissinger, and so was Roy Cohn. And in this article, I talked about Gelli's Masonic Lodge, and he was arrested in Switzerland the night before Grace's car crashed. He was arrested one evening, and the very next day she was killed, and that her connections to the Vatican were just too tangled, going there allegedly to make movies, and that among other people, Grace's sister, Mrs. Peggy Conlon, is quoted as saying that she thought foul play was involved in the death of the princess. Now, I wrote this a long time ago. That was in 1982, November the 2nd, 1982. I have reprints or can copy it if you want copies of this article. It just so happened that 3 weeks ago, Mrs. Peggy Conlon, her sister-in-law's husband, dropped dead several hours after Grace's brother dropped dead, and just before they died, Mr. Pacienza of the Vatican, the P2, was arrested in New York City. Right after they died, 2 days later, he was arrested in New York City, and Pacienza was fingered as being one of the people behind the murder of Aldo Moro, of Roberta Calvi, whose picture I had here. And also, interestingly enough, besides the arrest of Pacienza, and I'll go into that next week if we don't have time now, Archbishop Marcinkus, I mentioned, was in Palm Springs with Bob Hope several weeks ago, and I knew something very important was going to happen in role in terms of the Vatican. And right after Marcinkus went back to Italy, Grace Kelly's brother was killed, and her brother-in-law, whose wife was vocal right from the beginning about the murder of Grace Kelly were killed, and Pazienza was arrested in New York City. And with, there isn't time to go into this complicated story now. I probably shouldn't have even started to bring it up, but the common denominator, as I said before, is Michael Ledeen to the Pazienza story, and Michael Ledeen to Soldier of Fortune, and John Singlaub, and the other connections that I was going back to, that these various important stories have common denominators that link them all together. I don't have time to go into the Grace Kelly story, her brothers, or Mr. Pazienza, because there are some interesting articles I want to share with you on that. So we'll do that next week. I'll pick that up next week and then continue with some more of the current things that have been happening in the news. In the meantime, this is Mae Brussel, and this is program emanates from KAZU in Pacific Grove, California.